the San Francisco Experience podcast, independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 24, Episode 20, Rubik's Cube Turns 50, Talking with Tom Rokicki. This week, San Francisco's Moscone Center has been the host to over 5,000 mathematicians who are here for the Joint Mathematics Meetings 2024. And they bring together 17 mathematics organizations, including the American Mathematical Society, to share research and ideas. It was there that I met Dr. Tom Rokicki, whose passion is recreational computing. He's proven that you can turn a Rubik cube in 20 moves or less. With a PhD in computer science from Stanford University and a BS in electrical engineering from Texas A&M, Tom has had a storied career in Silicon Valley, but he's also passionate about playing whatever mathematical puzzles that come his way. He learned to code when he was just 12 years old. He's a featured speaker at the conference, and his subject matter is serious recreational mathematics, along with Erno Rubik, the creator of Rubik's Cube. Hello, Tom, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be on.
Tom, you hosted a large group of Rubik Cube aficionados last night at the Moscone Center, and they showed off their skills and speed. The cube was created by Erno Rubik in 1974, and it's named after him, of course. It continues to fascinate, challenge, and sometimes stump generations of players. Tell us about Rubik's Cube and your passion for mathematical puzzles.
The Rubik's Cube has always fascinated me. It's an amazing object. You think about it, you can twist it any which way and somehow all the pieces stay together. It's only got 20 pieces, but almost nobody can figure out how to solve it on their own. They have to be taught on YouTube or something like that. Mm-hmm. And yet, despite that difficulty, it has really endured. People continue to buy them, learn how to solve them, compete in solving them, and it's just the most amazing object. It's also just such a pure and beautiful representation of a mathematical group, which is a very abstract thing. And it's not just a simple group either. It's a relatively complicated group. But that's the only thing it is. It's this representation of this group. And yet you've got seven-year-old kids playing with this group and manipulating this group and learning how to take the group from one, you know, this position is from very scrambled all the way to solid. I just think that's so beautiful. I've just loved always playing with it.
As you said, it's kind of a physical manifestation of math. Of course, math I tend to think of as being somewhat theoretical, yet Rubik's Cube, you're right, is almost like a physical manifestation of math.
That's exactly right. And it's not only a physical manifestation, but it's also very clear. You give the cube to an eight-year-old, and you ask them, solve it. They know what to do. You don't need to tell them, these are the rules. You know, you can't move the pawn that way. Or, this is your en passant rule or anything like that. We don't have to tell them this is the special jumps you can do in checkers and the jumps you don't have to do. You hand them the cube, they immediately and intuitively know what the goal is. And so, I mean, that's incredible.
It is incredible. And it's also timeless. I mean, it was invented in 1974. Gerald Ford was president then. many of our listeners, if not most of our listeners, were not even born when it was first created and first made available to consumers. Tom, how long did it take you to do the research to come up with that 20 turns or less to solve the Rubik's Cube? Because that's for those of us who've tried to do it, I'm astonished that it could be done in 20 moves or less.
So let me tell you about the 20 move or less project first. I was sitting around a taqueria with some of my programming friends in Palo Alto in 1999. And we were just shooting the bull over lunch. And we were talking about challenges in computer science and challenges in mathematics. And I brashly said, I'm going to figure out what God's number is for the Rubik's Cube. In other words, how many moves it would take God to solve it in the absolute worst case. Uh-huh. And at that time, of course, I had no idea how to do this. Okay. I mean, I had been playing with the cube for a long time, but this was a really difficult problem. But I like difficult problems. So I said I was going to do it. And I worked on it a little bit as I had time. And in 2006, I wrote a little program that started to get some results and shared those results with other mathematicians and puzzle aficionados. And eventually, by 2010, we were able to develop the program to a point where it could run fast enough and we could actually borrow some of Google's computers to prove, go through all 4.3 times 10 to the 19th positions and show all of them could be solved in 20 moves. But it took significant effort, a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of refinements and a lot of help from my friends. I mean, a lot of good ideas from people I was collaborating with. It was a great challenge and it was a fun challenge because it's one of those challenges that it's over. You know, once you get to the point where you have the answer, you're done. Yes. And I love challenges like that. Most things in life are messy. You get a little bit further on and every answer opens up 5 new questions and stuff. And it's really nice to put this question to rest and be done with it. Mm-hmm.
Now, have you had an opportunity to share your findings with the inventor, Erno Rubik?
Yes, I have. As a matter of fact, we met for the first time in Atlanta at a conference called the Gathering for Gardner, which is a celebration that's held every 2 years in recognition of Martin Gardner and how he's inspired generations of mathematicians and scientists and engineers from his columns in Scientific American. I did speak with Erno, and he's incredibly gracious and a great guy. So we had a nice little conversation over a bunch of Escher prints. Seriously.
So tell me, so you've moved on from the Rubik Cube. What are some of the other mathematical puzzles that you work with? And tell us the challenges that you face and how you solve the puzzle.
So Rubik came out with another puzzle after the Rubik's Cube. The new puzzle he came out with was called Rubik's Revenge. And it's instead of 3 cubies on a side, it's got 4 cubies on a side. So it's called the 4x4x4 in the cubing community. And of course, that puzzle needs to be figured out. What's God's number for that puzzle? I'm not sure that will ever be known. I don't think I'm going to be capable of doing it, but it's certainly something I'm interested in and something I'm working on. So, and there's all sorts of variants of twisty puzzles as well. If any of your listeners are interested, they should check out, for instance, something called the Mega Minx, MEGAMINX. It's a great puzzle. And there's so many more where that came from. And then I'm sure at the exhibit yesterday, you saw all these different puzzles on the tables and everything like that. They're all similar to, derived from Rubik's Cube, and they all have their own character and their own interesting characteristics. So all of those, each one of those is its own little, you know, rabbit hole to explore.
In addition to the cube, which we all know, there were several other shapes there. There was like a pyramid, a triangle, a number of different shapes. Do they also conform to the 20 moves or less?
Some of them might. We don't know. We do know for some of the puzzles, for instance, the little 2x2 cubicle puzzle, we know that can always be solved in 11 moves. So that one's pretty easy. But for instance, for the 4x4, we don't have a clue. I mean, we know it's somewhere between probably 30 and 45 or something like that, but we don't know for sure. And certainly some of the more complicated puzzles, there's like almost no hope that we're going to get there unless some brilliant mathematician listening to this says, oh, I'm going to try and figure that out, apply some really good theory, and lets me know how they did it, because I want to know.
Uh-huh. Tom, having played with Rubik's Cube for as long as you have, and having sort of solved how many turns, the minimum number of turns that are necessary to do it, have you ever created your own mathematical puzzle? And if so, tell us about it.
Well, most of the puzzles I've created, and I have created a few puzzles, but most of them just aren't as iconic or interesting as the Rubik's Cube. I mean, I did create a packing puzzle. It's called a packing puzzle because you're given a certain number of pieces and you have to fit them in a container. And so you have to try different combinations. And the pieces I used were coins, and the container I used was an Altoid tin, because Altoid tins are a very specific size, mm-hmm. and coins are also very specific sizes. So So I wrote a computer program that helped me find nice combinations of coins that fit nicely in there, only a small number of ways. Yeah, most of the puzzles, I like solving them more than I like creating them. There are people that are really good at creating puzzles. I'm really not one of them. It takes a lot of skill and judgment and a really good sense of aesthetics to build a brilliant puzzle. And my aesthetic sense is not that highly developed. I mean, the Rubik's Cube is absolutely iconic in puzzledom. I mean, it's just so beautiful and so elegant. And there are puzzles that certainly approach that level of elegance, but it's a skill that I really don't have. So I mostly enjoy exploring other people's puzzles.
Tom, are there organizations, associations of like-minded individuals like yourself who come together to solve these puzzles, to talk about strategies, just talk about solutions?
There are many. There are organizations that focus on just what are known as twisty puzzles. So those are the Rubik's Cubes and its variants, like the Megaminx or, you know, the 4x4. And the World Cubing Association is the official body, the official organization that runs the sport at the moment. And they've got a huge organization, and it's all volunteers. I mean, it's these people devote so much of their time to setting up these competitions, making sure that the competitions are fair, the rules are established, understood, and followed so that, like, a world record that's set 3 years ago is comparable to a world record that's set 5 years from now, et cetera, and make these competitions available and accessible to small children all the way up to, you know, doddering folks like me. And the people in the World Cubing Association and the people around the World Cubing Association, the actual solvers and cubers, are always fascinated by all the mathematical questions of the cube. And yeah, there's lots of forums and stuff where the math is discussed and ideas are explored and computer programs are written and shared. And it's really a vibrant community. For puzzles in general, there are other organizations, and these are amazing organizations. There are puzzle parties where people have to invent their own puzzle, and they bring it to this party, and they share it with all the people at the party, and they just sit around and play with these puzzles and explore these puzzles. And sometimes the fun isn't even really solving the puzzle. Sometimes the fun is just appreciating the puzzle and getting a little bit on the way towards a solution of the puzzle. You know, I mean, not all puzzles have to be solved all the way. Sometimes it's fun just to get a couple of insights along the way. So, great organizations, magnificent people. And I'm just really happy that I know some of the people that are really good at this stuff.
Tom, is there a particular profile that a puzzle solver has? For instance, you've been at this for a long time, and you belong to other organizations, and of course you're going to be speaking on this subject along with Erno Rubik on Saturday at the JMM meetings in San Francisco. Can you give us a sense of the profile of puzzle solvers? Are they all mathematicians or not?
Oh, they're definitely not all mathematicians. Most puzzle solvers, especially some of the really fast ones, they're not really mathematicians at all. Indeed, as they solve the cube, they're actually doing math that they may not even be aware of the math that they're doing. I mean, a lot of the solvers, a lot of the world-class solvers are young teenagers. Mm-hmm. You know, they come in and they learn this puzzle, and they learn it so well, and they develop the manual dexterity, and they develop the recognition of the patterns and the algorithms they need. It's absolutely virtuoso. It's just absolutely virtuosic, or whatever the word is. They're virtuosos at the cube. Mm-hmm. And it's astonishing to behold. Indeed, one of the recent mathematical discoveries that literally set the mathematical world on fire was the discovery of something called the hat tile. And the person who discovered it was this fellow named Joseph Smith. And he's a wonderful guy. He's not really a mathematician, but he plays with these tiles, these shapes, and figures out how to fit them together in ways that don't leave gaps. And he discovered this brand new tile that had a particular characteristic that mathematicians had been looking for decades. Uh-huh. And it just set the world on fire. And all the mathematicians looking for it didn't find this simple shape. Joseph Smith found this simple shape. And it was amazing. So I can't say there's a particular profile. Anybody who likes challenges and isn't afraid to think about it a little bit can pick up a cube and learn to solve it. I mean, it's hard. It's not an easy puzzle, but it is an accessible puzzle. And you can make progress towards the goal of actually solving the thing as long as you don't give up and throw it at the wall, you know? And that's one of the fun things. I mean, I teach cubists. I teach people how to solve the cube in libraries sometimes. Children come in and we just show them how it works and one particular way to solve it. And maybe it takes them 5 minutes or 4 minutes to solve it the first time. And they get faster a little bit. And then I see them 6 months later at a competition in Berkeley and they're solving the cube in 30 seconds. Which is much faster than I can solve it myself.
Are there, for puzzle solvers like yourself, with these great skills of coordination, dexterity, perhaps maybe or maybe not having a mathematical background, do puzzle solvers tend to, what kind of jobs do they do in life? Are they able to translate those puzzle solving skills into a career? And if so, what kind of careers?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it's a little bit of a leading question because you're telling, you know, the STEM conferences are the ones that we tend to exhibit puzzles at, et cetera, because of the mathematical foundations and everything. But I don't buy that the people that are really good at these puzzles are the same people that are going to end up going into math or anything like that. Certainly, there's a connection there. And a lot of the people that are interested in the puzzles are also interested in math and other things. But I think there's a level of focus and determination and just interest and passion in solving the cube that lends itself to almost anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really think if someone has enough determination to solve one of these cubes, especially solve it on their own from scratch, that there's no limit. They can do anything they want. And certainly they can do math, but they could just as well, you know, do anything else, urban planning or I don't know what else there is, biology, mm-hmm. Who knows? You know, I don't think people are pigeonholed just because they're good cubers.
Mm-hmm. Tom, in addition to the twisty puzzles that we've talked about, I'm sure there are other mathematical puzzles. Can you share them with us? Do you use your computer for mathematical puzzles or do you pretty much stick with the twisty puzzles?
I like almost any puzzle or game. So one puzzle or game that I've been involved with is something called John Conway's Game of Life. And this is it's actually a zero-player game. You know, you've got multiplayer games like poker where you've got 10 people at a table. You've got two-player games like chess where it's two people. You even have one-player games like Klondike Solitaire, mm-hmm. where you basically play against a card. Life is a zero-player game. You set up a pattern of cells on a grid, and you press the button, and it does stuff. And the goal is, in a sense, to make it do interesting stuff. And this is something people have been playing with since the 1970s when it was invented by John Conway, a very famous mathematician. And it's a fun game. You generally play it on a computer because a computer is fast enough to actually display what happens. But people have actually built complicated machines, self-replicating machines in this game. I mean, the closest analog I can think of is it's similar to, what's that game called? The game where you've got all these blocks.
Oh, Minecraft.
Yes, that's it. Mm-hmm. Minecraft. It's like Minecraft. You build things and you can build things to do things. And it's just so much fun. Minecraft is more interesting for most younger kids these days because you get to fly around in a three-dimensional world. The Game of Life is played on a flat two-dimensional grid. There isn't as much flying around or anything like that. But it's been around a little longer, the Game of Life has. So I've played around with the Game of Life. Unfortunately, the advances in the Game of Life have gone way past me. The people building Game of Life stuff now are just so much more advanced than I am that I can't keep up. I mean, I get an email every couple of weeks in my inbox that is just full of all this new technology they built. And it's just amazing what people can do with it.
Are there any mathematical puzzles that are coming down the road that incorporate artificial intelligence?
I'm not aware of any. That sounds almost scary to think of. I mean, the last thing I need is like a pet dog that's smarter than I am. No, the artificial intelligence, the English it's generating is better English than most people in America can write. Mm-hmm. Better English than most people in America speak. So, you know, they certainly have the right grammatically correct and syntactically correct English. They may not make sense, but they can certainly pass, you know, your basic essays and stuff. So, yeah, that's kind of an interesting question. I don't know of any.
Mm-hmm. Tom, for someone who's just starting out in the world of mathematical puzzles, what would you recommend to a newbie, to a neophyte, somebody who's been fascinated at a distance and who would like to start? Where should they start?
I would get a Rubik's Cube. I would go out to Walmart or Target or wherever they have them, which is almost everywhere. Just buy a cube and see if you can do a side. As if you're young and you've got friends you hang out around with, maybe one of them can do it. You can share ideas. You know, maybe you can figure it out yourself. But I think it's really a wonderful, iconic puzzle. For other puzzles, Martin Gardner's books are just amazing. And you can still get them on Amazon. You know, Martin Gardner, just anything by Martin Gardner is going to be really good. Those two things, I think, are a good start.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, changing the subject a little bit, I know you've been very active with the International Collegiate Programming Competition. Could you tell us about that competition?
Certainly. So this is for college students who know how to program. They don't have to be computer science students. And it provides an ability for them to test and hone their skills at algorithmic programming, right? A program that solves a particular small problem. And they compete in how fast they can do it. And it's a lot of fun. Thousands and thousands of students participate nationwide, worldwide, indeed. This is international for the entire globe. Competitions are held everywhere. And I've been a judge for it for about 10 years plus, 12 years or something like that. I help write the programs. I help create the problem sets. And it's a great place for programmers to meet other programmers. It looks great on your resume if you've done well at it. And for me, it's mostly just a lot of fun. We try really hard to build the problem sets so the people competing are going to enjoy solving the problems. It builds on things they know. It's interesting, and they can enjoy talking about the problems afterwards and stuff. And it's a great community, and I'm just very happy to be part of it.
Now, you said it's international, so of course it's not just the United States. How many countries are involved in this, and how many competitors are there every year?
I don't have the numbers offhand, but I would say any country that's got a fairly large university system is involved. I mean, we certainly have competitors in Russia and Poland and China all over the place and everywhere else. So I can't think of a country that doesn't have competitions unless they're small enough that they don't have a university system. I mean, we try very hard to just make it available everywhere. As far as number of competitors, it's got to be tens of thousands and maybe hundreds of thousands. I'm not sure.
Well, Tom, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what are your closing thoughts for our listeners? And as I said, you've already addressed the issue of a newbie, somebody who might want to get started in mathematical puzzling, but share your closing thoughts with our listeners.
So my question is this. The Rubik's Cube is a representation of a mathematical group. This mathematical group exists outside of our world. This is something that it's math. Math doesn't need a concrete instantiation to exist. So all of the alien civilizations also have the same access to math that we do. So certainly they have this group, and they probably have the same puzzle. But they probably don't call it the Rubik's Cube, but certainly they have someone who has invented or will invent this puzzle. So my big question is, are those aliens going to be able to solve it faster or slower than we do? So when we have the intergalactic competitions, who's actually going to win? Mm-hmm. And does the alien's third hand, the gripping hand that comes out of their stomach, does that actually help them solve it more quickly or not? So all these questions keep me up at night.
Well, Tom, on that note, first of all, I'm looking forward to your lecture on Saturday morning. You will come right after Erno Rubik. So I'm looking forward to that lecture. And of course, we'll be publishing this podcast tonight. So all of our listeners, including hopefully the 5,000 mathematicians who are attending the JMM 2024 in San Francisco, they'll have an opportunity to listen to it also. And once again, I want to thank you for joining us and shedding light on this this fascinating icon from the last century, Rubik's Cube, which is as fresh and new and challenging as it was when it first debuted 50 years ago. Thank you, Tom, for sharing that with us, and look forward to having you back sometime.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure, and I hope to see any mathematicians listening. I hope to see you Saturday morning at the special session for recreational mathematics in room 024 of the Moscone Center.
And Tom, how can our listeners contact you? Website, X, Facebook?
The best way is I have a website that's cube20.org. That's cube20.org. And that's got the 20 moves result. And it's got emails on the bottom.
Do you have an X handle?
I probably do. But, I, you know, ever since Elon Musk took it over, I haven't really done anything with it. So
I see.
Well, yeah, sorry about that.
No problem. Well, once again, Tom, been great having you here, and I will have a front row seat on Saturday morning to listen to your lecture.
Fantastic.
And for our listeners, today's episode is number 486. The San Francisco Experience Podcast can be heard on Apple Podcast, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms, with listeners in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast. This has been the San Francisco Experience with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.